You are about to have the privilege to hear such a profound story from a profound individual. It's a story of loss, of tragedy, of frustration, of obstacles that hopefully we'll never have to deal with if it's up to me. And at the same time, it's a story of determination, of resilience, of strength and meaning that is taken from such a challenge and turning it into something positive, not without significant challenges and struggle, but turning it into something meaningful and adding to this world. I really, really don't think you'll regret hearing this episode and listening to our couples today share your story. If you would like to sponsor a future episode of Mental Filter, you can email us at mentalfilter@cbtbaltimore.com. As always, sharing, liking, your support is meaningful to us and helps us get to it. This is Mental Filter. Hey, welcome back, everybody, to Mental Filter, where we talk to interesting people about many interesting things, all through the lens of mental health. And this episode is no exception. As you heard a little bit in the introduction, this is, I would like to say it's a super unique story, but I've learned that it's not that unique, unfortunately. And even though it is specific to certain experiences and certain people, I'm confident that everyone is going to gain something from it when it comes to different types of losses and how we experience the loss itself and then how we respond and everything that comes after. So I'm really grateful that we have our co-host for today. And without further ado, I'm going to let her introduce herself, please.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity and hopefully this helps somebody else who's watching. But my name is Kelsey Hancock. I am a Marine Corps reservist out in Oahu and do kind of a bunch of things, actually. I have a photography business. I run a nonprofit called the Purple Skies Foundation. And I guess really the biggest reason why I'm here is because I experienced a pretty significant loss in my life. And that was when I lost my fiance, Nicholas Appio, who's a pilot in the Marine Corps. And we can talk a little bit more about that.
Thank you. Again, thank you for being here. We're going to get into all that, both what you experienced and also the nonprofit you mentioned, which I think is doing amazing work. So to sort of build up to your personal experience, for those civilians and lay people who aren't familiar, I guess, just tell the people about how you got connected to the service and your journey to just getting to the service.
Sure. So it was actually a lifelong dream ever since I was a kid. I wanted to be a Marine, and I don't think I even knew what that was when I was little, but the goal just stuck with me. And I knew I wanted to be an officer. I knew I wanted to go to a military college. So I applied to all the service academies and I applied to a bunch of schools that had the Corps of Cadets, which is a military program, like an ROTC program at the university. And I ended up at a school called Norwich University. It's in central Vermont. And I did my 4 years there. I commissioned as an officer in the Marine Corps from Norwich. And it's actually where I met my fiance, but at the time we weren't really in each other's friend circle. We knew each other, but we didn't really communicate.
You weren't even in friend zones. Forget about more than that.
Yeah, we were not in the friend zone either. And he was 2 years ahead of me, and he was also a member of the Corps of Cadets and also a part of the Naval Battalion, which is our ROTC section. So At military schools, there's kind of a hierarchy structure of rank. And I was a low person on the totem pole, and he was an upperclassman. So there really couldn't be much interaction, but we definitely knew each other. And we did have a few interactions that we would laugh about, later on when we reconnected. So
How strict, so now that you mentioned it, how strict is that? Like the, I guess it's the ranks, or like you can interact. Like, how can you tell a little more about that, and how strict is it, and what's it like if you're, it's almost feels like the caste system or something. Like, you can't.
it kind of is. I think the school takes it a little bit too seriously, to be honest with you. But I guess there's a method to the madness where, you start off as a freshman rook or recruit. We call them rooks. And the whole year is supposed to be to train and develop you. And it basically to establish you as a cadet. And then once you go through that entire, it's almost like an indoctrination process, to be perfectly honest with you. But you learn, you train, and then at the end of the year you become a cadet. And once you become a cadet officially, then you can have a little more interaction with the upperclassmen. But I think it's just to keep you focused and trained, and it's a tradition. So when I was a freshman, that's when I knew Nick, and he was a junior at the time. So that's
Did you find that helpful? Because I know some people, like the structure of that, actually they thrive in that. And I remember actually reading research a very long time ago. I'm not going to remember the specifics, that certain, people felt attracted to the service because they craved some of that structure. And I can also see some people with such rigid structures, like it's too constraining.
Right. That's a great question. I actually really, really wanted the structure because I knew what my goal was at the end of college, and I could have gone to any school, but I personally wanted the structure and the education and the environment to teach me how to be a better officer, because I'm a highly sensitive person, and I know that about myself, and I like that about myself. But I think when you expose yourself to challenging things, you become a little more confident. And I definitely needed that period to learn and make mistakes and do some trial and error and learn about myself and challenge myself before I commissioned. And I definitely think that helped me quite a
So you're basically doing your own exposure therapy in a way, yeah,
I
it's
realized
benefit.
that at the time.
Yeah, and so, knowing that about yourself, instead of like, okay, that's gonna define me, and then I have to stay away from things that are gonna make me uncomfortable, or it's gonna be hard, and instead you just went right into it. That's amazing. And you're telling me there was nothing. Did you come from a military family? It was just like the commercials, like there was, you remember as a kid, but you. Is there something particular that drew you to it?
I think growing up in Southern Maryland, I was surrounded by a lot of military influence. So, you have DC, you have, naval bases, you have Bolling Air Force Base, you have Joint Base Andrews, you've got Pax River Naval Air Station. I went to school right across the street from that base, and so I would see jets flying around all the time at recess. And a lot of my friends' parents were military. And I think growing up in church, we had a lot of service members at my church, and I felt this kind of level of respect from people who served when I told them that I was interested in the military. And as a girl growing up, I was a little sheltered. To feel like I had some respect from others because of what I wanted to do and pursue with my life, it was very rewarding. And I think I really liked that. And so I was encouraged to go into the military. I was very discouraged from going into the Marine Corps, though. They said any other branch but the Marine Corps. And I said, well, then that's exactly why I want to do it. So thank you.
Why was that? Why?
Well, I think it's because it's the hardest branch. And that's not to discredit any other branch of service, because each one has its own unique mission and roles that it plays, especially in a joint effort. But I think it's because everyone told me that it was the hardest, and that they were harder on women, and that they didn't accept women. Okay, well, if I'm going to do something hard and challenging, then I want to do the hardest one.
Yeah, good for you. Good for you. There's a couple really good takeaways in what you said. First of all, don't underestimate the value and the motivation that respect will give to someone. So clearly it's something that's very valuable to you, you know, and that pushed you to do it. Also, even though it maybe wasn't explicit, but being our environments and who we're exposed to, and there seems like there's a lot of like this implicit exposure to the military, and clearly, you know, that gets absorbed by people. So, and to be even more intentional, people, if I put myself in an environment that will be conducive for certain things that are valuable to me, that might help me. And if I put myself in a position where I'm in an environment that's really not, then that's gonna, you know, sometimes we try to overlook, like, no, you know, I'm impervious to this environment, to that environment. And clearly, environment does make a
Right, it does. Yeah.
difference. Okay, so you made it in. So let's like fast forward a little bit before you talk about your relationship and how that sort of evolved. I'm very curious to hear, and I'm sure like civilians are also, is like, what's it like to have a relationship while through school, while in service, while maybe one is active, one is not active? Like, how challenging is it to navigate relationships?
Well, I think it's different for everybody. I think Nick and I were in a very unique situation because we both served, and so I think the perspective is everything. I think there are benefits to having both served in kind of understanding the world and the expectations. Sometimes it's kind of challenging to express what the expectations are from an active duty service member to a non-service member, you know, because they lack the perspective of what it's like behind the curtain. But I will say, I think there are also benefits to having a non-service member partner. I think it just depends on the person, and I think it depends on the relationship and communication. Nick and I didn't start dating until we were both active duty stationed in California on Camp Pendleton. So we didn't date through college. We reconnected later on, and we overlapped our service a little over a year. So I would say it was kind of nice. I mean, I would be on base and we'd meet up for lunch. You know, we worked at different parts of base, and so we would meet up for lunch sometimes, and I would pass the flight line when I was on my way home, and so sometimes I would stop by the airfield, and I would leave little notes on his truck for him. Or, you know, it's just always nice. I would drive to work. I would look over to see if he was at work yet. You know, sometimes I'd see his truck, and it was always nice. But we would support each other. The funny thing is, I think this is a kicker. When he asked me to be his girlfriend, he was like, "Look, I'm deploying in 3 months. I really like you, but I totally understand if you don't want to start dating, you know, immediately because I'm going to be gone, literally leaving for 6 months." But I was about it, you know, like I'm kind of on this journey to develop myself, and it's fine because I kind of want to pour some energy into me right now, but I really care about you, and I think that we could really make this work. And we did. I mean, the communication was awesome. Just knowing that you have someone supporting you and caring about you. We went through two deployments together, and some people find it challenging. There were some challenges. We missed each other, but I also am my own person. I have my own things that I do with my life. I have my own hobbies and interests and responsibilities. And so I'm a whole complete person, and Nick was a whole complete person, and we just supported each other. And you know, he went deployed. I did what I was doing, and we communicated, and you know.
Sounds very healthy.
Yeah.
And you answered this a little bit. What kind of either logistical or even, I don't know if there's rules that there are in place that create some sort of limitations in having a relationship while in the military?
Certain rules, like, you know, officers and enlisted people can't have a relationship unless their relationship started before they went into the military. Like they would have had to be married before they joined the military. for instance. Or let's just say two enlisted service members are married and one decides they want to become an officer. That's totally fine too, because there was already, a relationship formed and marriage legally formed. And then there are rules in the chain of command. You can't date within your chain of command. So you can't date your supervisor or a subordinate. There are rules like that. But, for the most part, you can pretty much date who you want.
And any logistical like obstacles?
What do you mean by logistical
Like, I don't
obstacles?
know, is it, in military life, is it, well, you were fortunate you were serving, you overlapped and being in the same base. Like, I guess just scheduling military life, how does that get in the way of a, we'll call it a typical relationship?
Yeah, sometimes if you're in a dual military relationship, one person might be stationed somewhere else, or you might be on opposite deployment cycles where one deploys and then comes back and then the next deploys. I've seen that happen, but I think for the most part, the military does try to station dual military partners together or within a certain distance from each other. They really do their best to do that. It doesn't always work out, but there is a significant effort to do that. And I think, that just takes some coordinating with their kind of key stakeholders that facilitate those sorts of things. And I think it's just kind of communicating with them, like, hey, I'm married. Or even, for instance, if you're up for orders to change your duty station, people move all over the country, all over the world. If you're due for orders to change your location, which usually occurs every 2 to 3 years, and your partner, let's just say they have a really good job, or let's just say they're in college, or let's say you have a family member who has very specific medical needs, and where you're living provides the care that they need, those factors are taken into consideration as well. So maybe we don't move you across the country when your spouse is working or in college or has just started this really good job that, you wouldn't even need to work anymore if, if they had this job or, they need that specific medical care. I've seen that happen as well.
And I want to highlight, we're going to get back to this later, clearly, and everyone's going to understand in a couple of minutes. I want to highlight the words used with spouse. And when you talk about relationship earlier, you talked about, well, if you're married, stress on the word married before, then you can have the relationship. So we're clearly going to get into that and how that played a role for you specifically. So I guess let's, fast forward and getting into some more specifics of, you're experiencing your story. Please share with us.
Sure. Well, I'd love to just talk about Nick for a second, and then
Please.
we'll segue into that. Nick was an incredible person. I felt like it would be easier to talk about this every time, but like I have to get over that hurdle, that emotional hurdle. He was my best friend, truly. We went to college together. He commissioned as an officer in the Marine Corps. And then he went to flight school and he became an MV-22 Osprey pilot. He loved it so much. Goodness gracious.
Take your time.
He loved flying like more than anything. And he was so good at it. He was coined a once in a generation pilot. He was that good. People know Sloppy. That was his call sign. They wanted to fly with him all the time. He was an incredible instructor. He was leaps and bounds above his peer group as a captain. And I mean, there were times that he was flying special operations missions that, as a captain, when they're there were higher ranking individuals who should have been able to take those missions, but they wanted Sloppy to do it. And I talk about that all the time because I'm just so proud of him and all the hard work that he put into this. I mean, he would stay late to work to just help other pilots with their flight planning and teaching them and helping them work through problem sets. And, he would text me, "I'm going to be home late. Sorry, I'm helping so and so plan." And like I would always well up with pride. Like I wouldn't get upset that he was coming home late because he was doing what he loved and he was impacting other people. And so what he was, it's called a weapons and tactics instructor. And basically that is the highest certification that you can get as a pilot in the Marine Corps. So it's like the equivalent of Top Gun when you hear people talking about Top Gun in the Navy. So he was a WTI weapons and tactics instructor as a captain. And so, I mean, extremely qualified. He went on three combat missions or combat deployments, two to Kuwait, one to Saudi Arabia. And he was flying all over the Middle East. I mean, doing some pretty cool stuff. And I mean, he preached safety. He would come home sometimes, get frustrated at people at work who, wanted to maybe like cut some corners or not take certain safety protocols as seriously as they should have, or, take unnecessary risk. And he would never, he wouldn't sign for aircraft that were unsafe. He wouldn't fly aircraft that he didn't think were, up to the standard. If he was having an off day, he would take me off the flight schedule. I'm not flying. I need to be like clear-headed and in my right mind. And so I think because of that example, people felt very safe flying with him. Fast forward. Well, I don't want to fast forward yet. I want to keep talking about him for a second. He loved his friends. He loved relationships with other people and making sure he was investing time in others. He loved his family. He, would do everything he could to take his leave to go visit them. And he loved me. And I think it's one of the greatest gifts I've ever had in my life. And we weren't perfect. We didn't have the perfect relationship because that doesn't exist, but we loved each other very much. So, fast forward to June 8th, 2022. I knew he had a flight that morning. He had a very early brief, so he had to wake up at like 5 a.m., I would say. And we went through a normal morning routine. I woke up, I made us coffee, he got ready for work, I got ready to go to the gym. And I remember this morning like it was yesterday. And anyway, before he left, we hugged and kissed goodbye. And then he walked down the stairs and he shouted up from the stairs. And I would kind of look over the railing and he would look up at me and he just said, he called me Kale. That was a nickname that he gave me. So he, "Bye, Kale. I love you." And I just, said, "Fly safe. Text me when you land." That was the standard. You have to text me when you land, just so I know you're good. And he always did. And he was flying a normal routine training mission that day. It was in the same place that he would fly all the time. He's flown in that training area dozens and dozens of times. And I went about my day. He went about his day. And I would say it was around lunchtime for me. Yeah, it was around lunchtime. I went to let my friend's dogs out for them. They were some neighbors. And I missed a text from him and I didn't see it, but it was just, "Hi, I love you." And I got back home and I had a few extra minutes for my lunch break, so I was painting some trim real quick because I was doing some home renovations. And then I went and sat down back at my desk to work. I saw that I had a text from him. It said, "Hi, I love you." And I responded and I just said, "Love you too." And I noticed that it turned green, but I didn't really think anything of it because I knew he was flying. And so maybe he didn't have service and it turned green because of that. And then maybe an hour or two later, my aunt texts me and she said, "Oh my gosh, I heard about the Osprey crash in San Diego. Is Nick okay?" And my heart just sank into my stomach immediately. And I was like, "Oh my gosh, I haven't heard from Nick. He flew this morning. It's not this morning anymore. It's the afternoon." And I texted him and I basically was just like, "Please call me." And it turned green. And I was like, "What? Like, what?" So I go on Google and I just type in Osprey crash San Diego. And I saw this picture of like, it was just soot. It looked like a crash site, like an impact site. And there were parts and like components of an airplane, of an Osprey. But the actual plane wasn't there. And I thought, okay, well, maybe just hit there. That was an impact site. And maybe like the rest of the plane is out of frame or something like that. And then I later found that that was actually what was left of the plane because it had completely combusted and incinerated. So I tried calling Nick, he didn't answer. And then I tried calling his friend in the squadron and he didn't answer. And then I tried calling that friend's wife. And I just said, "Hey, have you been able to get in touch with your husband today?" She said, "No." I'm like, "Can you please try calling him because there was an Osprey crash today and Nick was flying and I can't get in touch with her Nick." She was also married to a Nick. And she said, "Yeah, I'll try calling." Then I tried calling the duty officer at Nick's squadron and I didn't get an answer. And then I tried calling Nick's best friend, who is an Osprey pilot at another Marine Corps base in San Diego, and I was able to get through to him. And so for me, I immediately knew because I was able to get in touch with him that Nick's squadron, the Purple Foxes, were in what's called River City. And River City is a term that we use when we need to basically disconnect all communication in and out of the unit. And we use it for a number of things. You use it in combat or like in on deployments sometimes. And then you use it when there's been a catastrophic mishap with a unit. Basically, it keeps information from leaking. It keeps the chaotic frenzy of, well, I was able to get in touch with my spouse. Oh, well, I wasn't able to get in touch with my spouse. And so now there's like this anxiety and chaos and uncontrolled friction, basically. And the military, especially the Marine Corps, has what's the word I'm looking for? Sacred, that's the word. The Marine Corps has a very sacred process on notifying family members in the event that their service member is killed in action or the line of duty. And so we don't want it to get on social media or people text stuff. There's a very, very specific process. So for hours, I mean, hours, there was nothing. I couldn't get in touch with anybody from the squadron. Nick's best friend from the other Marine Corps base was like, "You know, there was a mishap, but we don't know who it is yet." And, you know, I think he knew, but I don't think he wanted to. Again, I don't think he wanted to violate the sanctity of this process. And so I think he had speculations, but anyway, my friend came over, Lauren. Her husband, Nick, flew and worked with my Nick. And she came over to the house and just stayed with me. And then my friend, Lizzie, she also came over and stayed with me. And we're just like, okay, you know, haven't heard from Nick. And I was like, I think it's him. Like, I really think it's him. I feel like he would have sent me a quick text. Like, I feel like he would have been like, "I'm okay." But, you know, I'm like, it's him. And I was just busy keeping myself busy, cleaning my house, just trying to find something to do.
Yeah, I was
And
going to ask you, what's it like? I don't know if it's a big blur or you remember every single excruciating second. What are those hours? What is it like experientially? I
yeah.
don't know if you can even put it into words. What's it?
Yeah, I mean, I remember that day as clear as day. I remember as soon as I heard that there was an Osprey crash, I stopped everything that I was doing at work. I didn't even tell my boss that I was not going to be working anymore. I jumped in the shower because I was like, I'm going to need to put on something. I was wearing, gym clothes. I need to put on something presentable and I'm going to need to go get him. I'm going to need to go see him. He's probably at the hospital. He's probably banged up or something. I'm going to need to go get him, or I'm going to need to go to the squadron and take care of things. And so I cleaned myself up. I called my friends. They came over and I just started anxiously cleaning. I just was cleaning. And I'm like, there might be people coming to my house today. I don't know. So I'm just going to do something. And I was doing some pretty significant renovations. And so a lot of my living room was not put together. And I didn't even have like a lamp in there yet. And so it was just kind of a mess. And so I was straightening up and organizing and then just waiting. And, we're like, we should probably eat something. Let's get some soup, or we got ramen, I think. And so we ate a little bit of that. And I was just like, I can't eat. I can't eat. And, we talked and tried to make small talk and try to think, okay, like what could possibly have happened? Maybe they're just banged up. Like they were flying. I knew what they were doing. They were doing tail gunnery, which is basically you fly at a lower altitude and you have the back door open of the Osprey and you shoot 50 cal out the back. And you're in like this training environment. There's usually a target that you're trying to shoot at. And so like they're at a low altitude. Like if it crashed, like they'll be fine. Maybe they're pretty banged up, but they're coming from a lower altitude probably. So, and those are all the things that were going through my mind. And then my friend Lizzie, she had to go home to take care of her dogs. And not 2 minutes later, I get a knock on the door. And I thought, well, that's odd that Lizzie's knocking. Like she probably forgot something, but they always was just, she and her husband would always just walk in the door. That's kind of what we do. I was like, no, like I know what this is. I know exactly what this is. And I have a pretty long hallway from my kitchen living room area to the front door, and it felt like a mile, And I was like, I got another knock, and it was like everything I could to like not look through the little people. And, I was like, okay. I just remember thinking, like, please God, let this not be what I think it is. And it was, I looked through and it was three men in uniform, And when I opened the door, it was my friend Lauren, who was with me. It was her husband in his service alphas, and our friend Jimmy in his service alphas, and the MAG 39 chaplain, which is the Marine Air Group chaplain. And I was just stunned. I think, for 6 hours, I was thinking, I'm not going to see my fiance ever again. And so, I was crying, but nothing was coming out, if that makes sense. Like, I was just so overwhelmed with, like, I felt like I got hit by a brick wall, but there was something in my brain. We sat down and I don't think they knew what to say other than I'm sorry. And so I go into this like Marine Kelsey, that's the best way I can explain it, like Marine Kelsey came out. And I was asking questions like, okay, like what happened? Where were they? What's the 5 W's? Like, where is he now? Can I go see him? what do we think happened? Like, what could have possibly gone wrong? He is one of the best pilots in V-22 pilots in the Marine Corps. And they couldn't really answer anything. And then this is where it really hit me. I said, okay, well, what do I need to do? What do I need to sign? What do we need to do going forward? And they were just like nothing, Kelsey. Like, you and Nick weren't married. So, we're gonna have to coordinate with his parents. And I felt like at that moment, like every role that I played in Nick's life got stripped away from me. So it was like two losses in one day, Nick, and then who I was to him. And I'm a Marine. I know the world. I know the life. I know the process. I had to train on this process in the event I lost one of my Marines, and so I knew what needed to be done. And I just had to have my hands behind my back the whole time. And that hurt a lot. That hurt a lot.
First of all, thank you for sharing that. And that cannot be easy. None of us can even pretend to imagine what that's like. And no two losses are the same. You shared like so. There's so much like insight and I think a self-awareness throughout like every step of that. We first hear something, but we're not sure. Our minds almost try to latch onto something rational, something logical. Where, like you said, getting busy with organizing and cleaning, just like because, like you said, our system. It's almost like, again, I was never in those shoes, so I can't pretend to know what it feels like. But our systems are overwhelmed and they're overloaded. And if I just sit here. Don't get me wrong, I'm a big believer in letting us feel emotions. This is what I do. But in the beginning, it's like this tsunami, I guess. And to sit there just with that is like quite overwhelming. So it's got to be, expected to try to lash on something, then try to rationalize and try to, come up with something that would explain it. I mean, we all want to understand things. And so there's a loss, like you said. Then there's a lot of missing information. And we'll maybe talk about the little bit of like being the fact of your official status. Did you get information and get some sort of, so you don't necessarily are allowed to have a certain amount of closure to understand, even if it's tragic, there's some value in having information of like what happened as opposed to leaving it very ambiguous. There's a term that I've used before in the podcast, that ambiguous loss, which is like this almost like open-ended. No finality to it, and you're sort of left hanging, and it doesn't let us really find that full, closure. Then what you were hoping wasn't true was at your doorstep, literally, and you don't even have time to process it. And like you said, I couldn't say it better than you. It's like, insult to injury. That's I have this loss. I can't even get to really fully experience that loss and. What's you get hit by a ton of bricks and after is there at that point in time is there anger is there just sadness is there is what's going on in those moments?
Yeah, I was just numb. I mean, I've maybe when you're coming to from anesthesia or something, just in a state of delirium. I mean, what is real now? Like, that's kind of how I felt. Like, everything was slowed down. Everything felt like it was slow motion. I felt slow. My brain felt slow. I couldn't think. I remember saying to myself, because my friend said, grab Finnegan. He's my dog. You could pack a bag. You're gonna come stay with Nick and me tonight. And I said, okay. So I go upstairs, and I'm like, What do I need? I need this, I need this, I need this, I need dog food for Finnegan, I need. And then I had to like say it over and over and over again. I need this, I need this, I need this, I need this. 'Cause like, and then I just piled a whole bunch of stuff in my backpack. And I got in the car and we left, and I sat in the back of the car with Finnegan, and I remember it was like a clear, starry night. And I was looking up at the stars while we're driving and thinking, like, am I alive? Like, am I dead? Like, I don't know. Am I even here? Is this even happening? You know, and thinking, like, it's so clear out. Like, there was no like weather. It wasn't cloudy. It wasn't raining. It was a beautiful, clear June day. It wasn't even like hot outside yet. It was, you know, it was like June gloom, but you know, it was a sunny day in June. And like, this must be not real. And then we get home, and it was a perpetual state of delirium for months, if not, and it eased up a little bit, but I would say the past year and a half, I was literally just talking to the co-pilot's wife this morning. It's actually their seventh, it would have been their 7th year anniversary today. So I was talking with her a little bit this morning. I said, the past almost 2 years doesn't feel real. Like, it just doesn't feel real. And so my concept of time, I mean, I was 29 when that happened. I'm almost 31. And that whole chunk of time feels like it never happened. And so it's like having a traumatic brain injury. I really believe that's what it equates to, because
That is a very fascinating way to frame it. Yeah, I can't dispute it. There's such a fascinating dynamic there. So on one hand, it's almost like chunks of time are not there, and it's not doesn't feel real, whatever term you want to use for it. And at the same time, some of the like the minutiae, some of like the details, you can paint such a vivid picture of the starry night and the weather and you know the colors, and there's some things that are printed. When people experience something at like traumatic and something our systems experience something as severe as that, it almost gets like imprinted. You know, people can remember a smell, the song I was playing on the radio, whatever it is, like that's so vivid. And at the same time, there's like so much that's not, which is to me is like a fascinating our brains, our bodies. It's like it's so complex. I couldn't necessarily explain it sufficiently. And there's also something you said earlier that even though you've been trained, you've trained people for this, which speaks like no matter how much we can like read in a book, we can train, we can talk about, you know, I can be an expert in whatever it is, and I can write 20 books on it until I experience it. I can't know how I'm going to respond. I can't know how I'm going to react. I can't know what it feels like. I think it's very important for people to appreciate whether it's themselves, because there's no right or wrong way to experience something, and people should give themselves some grace, you know, when if they do have to experience something like that. There's, oh, I should have been prepared, and I should be able to handle it this way and that way, and I imagine that there are people that struggle with that. You can't be prepared. It's like you can't be prepared. You could be the authority on it, and you just can't be prepared. Do you think, maybe this is an unfair question, so you don't have to answer it, you know, Monday morning, you know, quarterbacking, different of an experience you think it might have been for you if your official like status was different? So also I maybe fill some people in as far as like not being married versus being married in the military, maybe just give a little intro to people on that. And then do you think that, listen, the loss is the loss, the trauma is the trauma, you think it would have been a different experience?
I think it would have been, but I think it also would have brought on other sets of challenges that we don't really need to get into. But I would say, I think when we experience stuff like this, we want to control uncontrollable situations. And I think that's, I feel like, a normal human reaction. And I have always been a handle it type of person. like, okay, we have this problem, not necessarily a fix it, but solution seeker, you know? And I feel equipped, and I felt equipped to handle things because he was my best friend. I knew him better than anybody. I mean, truly, he had so many people who loved him and so many people he loved who I believe knew parts of him that were very important, and those relationships are very important. But I truly felt like I knew Nick better than anybody. I mean, we were going to be married. So you open up differently to your life partner. You disclose different things to your life partner. There are things that Nick told me that he has never told anybody, anyone. Emotions that I got to experience with Nick that no one has ever been able to experience. And I think for me, I just wanted to be able to honor him in every possible way that I knew as a partner to him, but also as a Marine. Because those two things, like, that is who I am. And I felt like I was not either of those anymore. And those are two very significant parts of my identity. And so I feel like, you know, maybe a flow of communication. I would have received a flow of communication from the squadron, from the casualty advocate officer. I was sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes the last person to know certain things. And that really hurt. That really, really hurt me. And, you know, trying to take a step back and think, okay, other people are experiencing pain and loss too, and so how they're processing information, and am I the first person they're thinking about to tell? I don't know. I would hope that I would be. I think my expectations were high because it's what I would have done if the roles were reversed. And but regardless, it hurt. And I think it's going to take years to work through. And I am working through it. I'm a really great therapist, but you know, it's collat it was kind of collateral trauma, you know. And so not being able to be in the rooms during certain discussions, that was frustrating, you know.
So that's the rule straight across the board. Unless two people are married, they're like almost like persona non grata.
Yeah, and I am very fortunate because there are other significant others who have experienced this, who did not have the same background that I do. I was very fortunate to be a Marine and to know the questions to ask, to know the system and the process, and to know who was like going to be able to give me information if I needed it. And so I was very fortunate to have had really good relationships with people. And at the time when it passed, I had to paint a little bit of a picture. I had been out of the Marine Corps for a few years, about 2019, 2020, about 3 years. I had been out of the Marine Corps. And I was like, I need to come back in. I need to come back in because I think I'm going to be able to know more, do more, and influence more if I'm wearing the uniform again. So I came back in.
Is very very intentional, and I imagine this is going to be one of the things I was curious about, especially particular to flying. I could see people going in both directions. You were very like, determined, very intentional, strategic, if you will. I can also see people who just experienced such an intense loss to like, that is the last thing that I want to do. I want to stay away from anything and everything that reminds me of him, of that hope, every, so. Was there, seemed like there was no hesitation at all.
It was a month, about a month after he passed. I was staying with the family up in New England, and I walked outside and I called a prior service recruiter, and I just said, "Hey, this is my story. This is what's happened. I'm going to come back in. I'd like to be a reservist at least until I figure out what my life is right now, and what he got, and he took care of everything. I mean, it was processed within weeks, and then about a month later, he sent me a text, and he just said, "Hey, ma'am, I just want to let you know, like, welcome back to the gun club." And he said it, and I will never forget it. He said, "Ooh, it gets me emotional thinking about it." He said, it's been an honor doing this for you because you're the last person that I've put back in, for this job. And I'm moving on to bigger and better things, And it was just like, wow, So
Wow.
So anyway, I think being back in helped me feel connected to the organization again. It made me feel like I could pour my energy into something impactful while I felt like I could do nothing, if that makes sense. And it's like, okay, I have a direction. I had to step away from my corporate job at the time. I had just started with a new company 2 months prior to Nick passing, and they would not give me paid bereavement leave. And there was a whole scuttle of drama with this company, like labor law violations, to include like a little bit of retaliation. And I just, you know what? This is not a company that I want to work for. So I left, and I had no plan. I had no other job lined up. I had what little money that I had coming in from another income stream, and that was it. I didn't receive spousal benefits from Nick passing away. I was not the beneficiary. And so I had really no plan. And I had a couple friends start a GoFundMe for me, and that was enough to like help for a little bit. And some of the spouses in the squadron, they collected some funds for me, and that was really kind, and that helped for a little bit. But I really had no plan. I was like, all right, I'm just gonna go in the Marine Corps. I'm gonna figure it out, and I'm going to try to see how I can make the most out of this and make an impact somehow. Like,
Wow.
something needs to be done.
So to connect what you said earlier about the desire to control the uncontrollables, and you put all your energy into controlling the controllables. Wow. Takes a lot of resilience to do all that. Wow. So do you remember the first time you got behind cockpit flying again?
So I wasn't a pilot in the Marine Corps. I had a different job, but I started flying lessons to get my private pilot's license. And the first time I got to fly, it was a discovery flight with my friend Megan, who is also an Osprey pilot and one of Nick's best friends. And I came out for my first set of drill in Hawaii last year. And she was stationed here at the time, and she took me on a discovery flight. And it was euphoric. And then the first time I got to actually fly with an instructor, I just felt so overwhelmed and emotional because it was actually Nick's flying club in San Diego. I got hooked up with my instructor there and joined the club. And, I went to the Went to the like in brief, which I went to his in brief with him. And so sitting back on that couch in that room, in like the ready room, getting briefed for me, I was like, he would be so happy. He would be so happy that I'm doing this. And it was amazing. And I'm addicted. So I'm actually part of a flying club out here in Hawaii now. So I'm still plugging away, trying to save all my pennies for flight instruction. So,
Wow. I mean, that's just so tremendous. I have to say, hearing this, it's like the epitome of making meaning out of loss, which is like, you can't ask for more than that, to like, to take it and to make meaning and to honor Yeah, can it come and come full circle and to like lean into it? I mean, sure, it's not without lots of obstacles and internal challenges, but that's like that's tremendous. That's I mean, kudos to you.
Well, one thing most people don't know is I actually put a package in with the Marine Corps to do a lat move from my MOS, which is my job, to 75XX, which is Student Naval Aviator. And it was 7 months after Nick passed. I took basically it's the pilot aptitude test for the military. And I passed. And I also got medically cleared to be a student naval aviator. And I put in a package. I got 06 level endorsements, which is the colonel endorsements. And I got letters of recommendation. And I had a pretty compelling personal statement. And I went to flight school with the Marine Corps. So I did that. And, I had to request a waiver because I was a reservist, and I think that's why I didn't get accepted. But I was very willing and ready. But the Marine Corps said no. And I tried, so
Be able to try again?
I think I could, and we'll see.
Got
We'll see. I think with what I'm doing or advocacy
Right,
in
that's
terms
exactly what I wanted to ask about next. Can you tell us about that? This is not just it's not just your own personal journey that has motivated you, but it's also the advocacy, the nonprofit. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it would be a little bit of a conflict of interest if I, became an active duty aviator in the Marine Corps while advocating for what we're advocating for. So I have been so blessed to be part of an amazing spouse group from Swift 1-1, which was the call sign of Nick's plane. Amber Sachs, Avery Rasmussen, Emily Baxter. They're just wonderful human beings, and we are determined to make a significant influence in the military aviation community in terms of safety and reestablishing baseline standards of what's acceptable risk. And Nick's mishap was very unique in a way that it was one of the first times the Marine Corps has seen a catastrophic failure such as this. So we've seen in history elements of Nick's mishap occur singularly, but with everything that happened in Explain, this is one of the first times that, or if not the first time, anyone has ever seen this. So it was a multi-part mechanical failure. And what happened was he had a dual hard clutch engagement, which basically caused total engine failure on the left engine. And there's a redundant system in the plane. It's called an ICDS, which stands for Interconnected Drive System. And it's a redundant power source in the plane that has made the Osprey what it is. And it's known for its redundant features. And for the most part, it works. But what we think happened is that when the left engine failed, the ICDS over-torqued the right engine, and that power system failed. It was a total system failure. And it caused the right engine to degrade, which basically caused total loss of thrust to the right engine. And so the plane essentially kind of like ate itself in the sky. And it just fell right out of the sky. And there was nothing that they could have done about it. Like he could have known ahead of time that it was going to happen, and there wouldn't still not have been enough time to rectify. There was literally, I mean, you could have been a genius and still not know how to fix that. And it started really with a hot gearbox, which is typical in rotor aircraft, but I would offer that it shouldn't be typical. I mean, if you have a continuous problem in rotary wing aviation, then it's probably something you should figure out how to not have happen continuously. But regardless, the protocol for a hot gearbox is to climb to a higher altitude. And where they were roughly was about 500 AGL. And so it was high enough, but it was low altitude to do the exercise that they were doing. And they were flying in helicopter mode, which is where the nacelles are like this, and you have like the prop rotors going like that. Okay. And part of the protocol again is to climb to a higher AGL and to transition from helicopter mode to airplane mode. So the nacelles go down like this, and there's a component here. It's like an open compartment that allows airflow to go through the system. So there's a natural cooling process that occurs when you go higher in altitude, and then you have that airflow going through the system. So that's the protocol. Makes sense. Nick has had hot gearboxes all the time. That's what he does. And within 11 seconds after that radio call saying, I have a hot gearbox, I'm basically enacting what was briefed in the pre-flight brief, he was on the ground. 11 seconds. So, peeling back the layer, and we were talking earlier about how, when you don't have answers, you don't know what happened. There are a lot of unknowns that cause stress and anxiety, and like ambiguous. You called it ambiguous
Us.
loss. We didn't really know what happened officially for 13 months. So the families got briefed in July of 2023, 13 months after the mishap. And within that span, Amber Sachs and I did a lot of research. We read a lot of books. We gathered as many facts as we could. And then we sat in the brief to the families in Quantico, and some things just didn't add up. And representation from the manufacturers did not come like they said that they would. And we started peeling back the layers a little bit more. And there's a part in the plane that is a program of record that has failed a few times. Redesign has failed as well in 2010 and 2017. And there's some work that needs to be done in making sure that the aircraft is safe to fly. And right now, the entire Marine Corps, all of the Ospreys are grounded from flight, and they have been since November due to another catastrophic mishap that occurred with the Air Force. It was a CV-22, and that killed eight service members in Japan. So
That's pretty telling.
it's telling. The Marine Corps isn't the only service that flies the Osprey. It's the Air Force, the Navy, the Marine Corps, and the Japanese Defense Force. And so they're all manufactured by the same manufacturer. So typically, when there's an issue or concern with one of the service components aircraft, there's a lot of discussion that occurs between all service components. And there's usually a decision to say, okay, we should probably ground them, or we should look into this problem more. And there's a constant sharing of information just to align policy, procedure, and safety under 800 flight hours. So 800 is the limit. There have been claims that doing that will mitigate the risk of a mishap like Swift 1-1 occurring by 99%. And I don't think that's true at all. I think that's a very inflated number. We've asked for copies to see how they came up with that percentage, and we have not been given that information. I also know that we're doing the hour limit thing. Great. That's awesome. That's, I think, an 80% solution to this. But Bell Boeing tried to redesign this program in 2010, and it failed. And so for the next 7 years, the Marine Corps flew with that failed program of record. And then again in 2017, they tried to redesign the program again, and it also failed. And so
Are these pilots aware of this?
they are now. They are now.
So what would you say your hope and dream dream is when it comes to like safety and what do you hope happens?
That's a really great question, and I'm so glad you asked that. My hope and ultimate goal is to see the Osprey flying safely and with a new set of standards and policies. I have friends who are still flying, and I've seen friends turn in their wings because they're not comfortable flying this aircraft anymore, and that's really devastating. The Osprey is an incredible asset to the military. I mean, it's one of the things that makes the Marine Corps Expeditionary. Every time I see one flying, I think of Nick. He dedicated 10 years of his life perfecting this aircraft, and I want to see the program flourishing. We need a higher level of scrutiny when it comes to manufacturers, and I don't know if it has to do with quality assurance or if it has to do with allocating more funds to the program. But there needs to be a standard baseline of quality aircraft that we're flying, and there needs to be a level of transparency. You're asking Marines and other service members to do a very risky job. There is risk associated with flying, whether you're a commercial pilot or a military pilot. That's inherent risk. We accept it. But when there are component issues and part issues, and manufacturers know about these things, and services know about these things, we need to do better. So that's what I would like to see. I would just like to see it safe. I would like to see a very deliberate action and transparent action in what the service components are doing and what the manufacturers are doing to prevent anything like Swift 1-1 happening ever again.
Amen to that. Amen to that. And so this, the whole safety and trying to create more oversight, that's something you're doing more on your own, or you said with someone, that's completely on your own.
Yeah, on my own, with Amber Sachs, who has been such like a huge leader in this, being a spouse and to John, her late husband, that is something she's been able to spearhead more than me. I don't have any legal standing, but I am so grateful for her and so thankful for the other spouses and Evan Strickland's parents, Brett and Michelle, who have just included me in everything. We are one team. We support each other. We're very aligned in our mission. And I'm so grateful for that because, for the most part, I feel like I've been fighting this with two hands behind my back. But Amber, who has really spearheaded this, has included me in everything. And I could not be more grateful for that.
It's amazing to be part of the team. So independent of that, now I guess you can tell us a little bit about Purple Skies.
Yeah, so I started the Purple Skies Foundation because I was not the beneficiary of Nick's, spousal support because we weren't married yet. I really struggled. I really struggled. I couldn't work. I mean, I really could not work. I started a little photography business to kind of make ends meet. I applied for dozens of jobs. I mean, I was sending my resume. I was even interviewing when I was staying with the family. I was interviewing on like Zoom calls and stuff for other jobs, just trying to find something. And for the life of me, I couldn't find anything. And to be honest with you, I probably was wearing my emotions on my sleeve. Like, I don't think I was articulate enough at the time to say, yeah, I'm ready, qualified to work a job. I honestly wasn't. I was not with it. But I reached out to a whole bunch of nonprofits who I knew were helping other families and other spouses, and I was just like, hey, I'm the surviving fiance of Captain Lasapio. He was part of this crew, and I'm really struggling right now. I have a mortgage. I just had to step away from my job. Is there any way that you'd be willing to help or connect me with someone? Or, do you know anyone who's hiring because I could use a job? I don't necessarily need free handouts. I need a little help. And probably 80% of those organizations said, we're really sorry for your loss, but we can't help you because you weren't married. And it's like a gut punch after gut punch because, you're seeing your friends get help and you're seeing other people get help and so got it. So then I'm like, okay, well, I'm a veteran. Do you do anything for veterans? Like any chance you could or do you know any organizations that help veterans? And, it was just kind of, yeah, I'm really sorry. Or yeah, you can check USA Jobs or something like that. It's like, okay, got it. I've checked USA Jobs. I'm on LinkedIn, So I realized there was a huge gap between Gold Star families and other. And I was other. And I knew in my heart that I wasn't just other. I was more than other. And I wasn't going to let this dictate my relationship with Nick. And in communicating with others on social media, there were a bunch of fiance types and girlfriend, boyfriend types who reached out to me and said, "How have things been for you? Because for me, this is what happened. And I got zero help. We had a mortgage, or I had to leave my apartment because I couldn't afford it anymore. Or, there were all these other collateral losses that occurred in the back end." And I was like, oh my gosh, this is a huge need. This is a huge need. And I can sit here and be upset and a little bitter about my situation, or I can do something about it. And so I chose to do something about it because that's just the type of person I am. And I did not want anybody else to experience what I did. And it's like the constant struggle after loss. I mean, it is like the how am I going to pay my bills? And I'm a very hard worker. Like I have a huge work ethic. I do not like asking people for help. I had a really good job when I got out of the Marine Corps. I bought a house, I would consider myself a very successful, driven person, and I found myself flat on my face. And
Sounds so isolating.
yeah. And I had a great community of military families in the area surrounding me and helping me. And, my friends were, I mean, went above and beyond. Above and beyond. And my sister, she came in, my sister came and moved with me for 6 months just to help me pay for my house. She got a new job. She moved to a different city just to help me. I don't know too many people who would do something like that. So I
So
was
the
like, I
nonprofit, so it started when?
launched it officially on June 8th, the 1 year anniversary in 2023.
Okay. And so far, so what's the mission?
The mission is to resource all significant others of service members killed in action or the line of duty. And I say resource specifically because it could be anything from financial resourcing to emotional resourcing to connecting and networking type resourcing. Everyone's needs are probably going to be different. We're going to have maybe spouses come who might have a very different financial situation than, let's say, a fiance or boyfriend, girlfriend. The needs just might be different. And so maybe they just need to be connected with a support group and they just heard, oh, the Purple Skies Foundation does post-mishap support. Or maybe they need help with childcare. Or maybe they just need a week's worth of groceries, Or let's say a boyfriend, girlfriend lives in a different state and they're like, I can't afford a plane ticket to go to my significant other's funeral. We want to be able to do that, or to just be shoulder to cry on, to be like, this is the process. This is, these are the questions to ask if you're not being included in anything. Here's what you can ask, demand it. You deserve a seat at the table, even if it's limited. You just still deserve a seat at the table because you loved this person.
In addition to that, is part of Purple Sky's opus to advocate for changes, policy, or is it now right now focused more on the support?
I think right now it's more focused on support, but I think it would be advantageous to take a look at policy again. I have to do a little bit more research, but as Marines, we are supposed to update our paperwork constantly. And by paperwork, I mean who's getting our life insurance, who's the beneficiary. We can do wills before deployments. We can, there are a lot of resources in that regard. Nick had it updated his for almost 3 years. And how he annotated me on his last, basically, will sort of paperwork was not, she's about to be my wife. It was like, she's an emergency contact because we just started dating. And that's a big, big difference. And that's definitely not how he would have annotated me. And on the flip side, you want to make sure your paperwork is updated in case there's someone you don't want on there anymore.
Right.
So, but Nick, in this year in particular, Nick went from a training environment. He was home for 3 days and he immediately deployed. And usually before deployment, the squadron does pre-deployment paperwork. They go through everything. They go through like their wills, they go through their life insurance policies, they go through, does somebody get power of attorney for their vehicle or their house or their mail? And Nick gave me power of attorney for his stuff, thankfully, but that didn't help anything else. And we had plans to just combine all of our assets after we got married. That was the plan. We had kind of a drawn out a timeline of like, okay, we're gonna get married this day, we're gonna do this road trip, we're gonna go up to where, he lived to see the family. I was going to become a resident in that state for, tax purposes, and because that's where his home of record is. And then we were going to go down. He got accepted to be part of the presidential helicopter squadron in Quantico, Virginia. And so we were then going to drive down to Virginia and start
So,
our life there.
right.
So.
So a big piece, you're saying a big piece is this education and just simply sounds so simple, but simply updating paperwork. That's monumental impact.
But then, I look back sometimes and I think, would I be here doing what I'm doing if I was the recipient of anything? Would I be the same person? And even though there's been a lot of struggle and frustration and like anxiety and collateral trauma that has become of this, I'm so thankful because I feel like the joy that I've received from helping others and finding ways to give back, that's priceless, and I'm really thankful for this trajectory. I don't know if I would have fought as hard if everything was just easy after.
Right. And, adversity forces us sometimes to do something and create something. And yeah, can say it better than myself. So, wow. So along those lines, this was both fascinating, painful, inspiring. If people want to get to know more and they want to help and they want to connect, can we direct them?
So you can go to the Purple Skies Foundation on Instagram. It's just at the Purple Skies Foundation, all one word. We also have a website. It's just thepurpleskiesfoundation.com. And you can peruse the website, see what we do. We do donations, and we actually just designed a patch that we're going to be selling soon.
Oh.
Some more traction, and usually around times where we see mishaps occur, we'll put something out to just say, hey, if you want to support families who are struggling with the aftermath of something like this, we're a resource and we really appreciate your donations. We're a new organization, so we're going through the growing pains of kind of a startup, but it's
Back
very,
to being a rook.
yeah, it is. But I have great people on the team who are some of Nick's closest friends and my closest friends, and A lot of people willing to volunteer, and it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. I wish you all as much success and helping people. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.